Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine broadcasting on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS Low Power 98.9 FM Schenectady from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. I'm Kalen.
And I'm Justin. Tonight, we start by talking with Samuel Caldwell about the University at Albany's commitment to diversity and inclusion at the events that happened for Black History Month.
Then we commemorate Malcolm X in a five-part series about his views and how they apply today's freedom struggles. HMM Willie Terry speaks with Brother X in part two.
And later on, we talk about personal finance, the racial wealth divide, and spending in the line with your values with Brunch and Budget founder and lead financial advisor, Pamela Capalet.
And after that, we speak with a family book author, Ruth Ann Smalley, about her new book, Defender of Dirt and More.
Finally, RPI student Anika Strelo interviews Jess Bennett of Friends of the Mohican Tuck about their mission as an organization. But now, some headlines.
With growing state and national criticism over his handling of nursing home and COVID, the governor is planning to relax rules, making it easier to visit nursing home patients. More than 70% of such residents have now received vaccines. Meanwhile, the governor's handling of nursing homes was paranoid on Saturday Night Live. On Saturday Night Live, and the New York Times wrote a story for his reputation on being a bully. State legislator will vote this week to take back at least some of the emergency powers that they gave the governor to deal with COVID.
A mass vaccination site will open at Albany's Washington Avenue Armory that will deliver 7,000 shots a week. It will be one of six sites statewide designed to reach socially vulnerable communities, meaning predominantly people of color who would otherwise have less access to the vaccine or on the average more distrusting of it.
The Gazette reports the new health guidelines for Schenectady County School District should receive the reduced numbers of students and staff ordered to quarantine after close contact of a positive COVID-19 cases are identified. The Capital Region's COVID-19 test positivity rate this weekend dropped below 2%, and statewide average dropped below 3% for the first time since before Thanksgiving. The national death toll, however, is rapidly approaching 500,000.
A community forum by the Schenectady Coalition for Healthcare Access will be held on March 4th to allow community members to voice concerns or ask questions about the merger between Schenectady's Ellis Medicine and Albany St. Peter's Health Partners.
The record reports that girls in Lansingburg area can now sign up for two programs that bringing focus on physical health and self-confidence. Registration is now open for the 8th week Girls on the Run and Heart and Soul programs, both scheduled to be offered from March 22nd through May 1st at the Troy YMCA, located at 2500 21st Street in Troy. Practices are from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. on Thursdays and 10 to 11 a.m. on Saturdays for both groups.
The record also reports that the city of Troy will enter into agreement with East Greenbush in Bethlehem to create 4 household hazardous waste days this year. The state will pick up half the cost.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. This is local news produced by the community for the community, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
This program is kept on the air by many volunteers and Sanctuary Soustonnaires. Thank you. To hear all of our stories on today's program, visit mediasanctuary.org. To send comments, suggestions, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook at Media Sanctuary.
Samuel Caldwell, the interim chief diversity officer and assistant vice president at the University of Albany, discusses the university's commitment to diversity and inclusion. Two of the main events being put on in the honor of Black History Month.
Hi, this is Spencer Keeble. I'm a student at UAlbany with the School of Public Health. Today I'm joined by Samuel Caldwell, who is the interim chief diversity officer and Assistant Vice President of the Office of Diversity and Inclusion at the University at Albany. Sam, I wanted to talk to you, ask you about Black History Month at the University at Albany. What kind of events are going on? What's the atmosphere like?
I appreciate that, Spencer, and I thank you for the opportunity to join you today. I'll open by offering that with the university still not necessarily being back to full capacity, at least in terms of the population of students and the residence halls and the like, that we are still very focused on providing programming around Black History Month that allows for the students that are here, faculty and staff as well, and other members of the immediate campus community to be able to have some sense of perspective around the contributions of African Americans and those who are friends and allies, advocates of the Black community, as it were, to be able to enjoy programming that's specific to, in many ways, the Black experience in America. And I'll speak to two, if I could. The first is an exhibit that is in the Campus Center West, Great Hall. So anyone who hasn't had an opportunity to take advantage of a trip to Campus Center West, perhaps it's something that you can take in, even as you're enjoying your Starbucks order or any of the other food or beverage items at the Campus Center. It includes a couple of components. There are panels that are on loan from the New York State Museum that offer different perspectives and renderings of a draft of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. It's a facsimile of one of those drafts. It also includes some commentary and photos from Martin Luther King Jr.'s visit to New York City in 1962 on the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. So it's a very well done exhibit. It translates very nicely to the space. And it also includes the ability to download through a very quick QR scan code the speech itself that was offered by Martin Luther King Jr., which is also running on a loop in a video that is adjacent to the Campus Center West Great Hall. So I'd ask anyone who hasn't had an opportunity to take advantage of that to please do so. And we also have a virtual program this upcoming. That is on Monday, the 22nd of February. It is our annual Martin Luther King celebration event. It's going to be staged, as I mentioned, virtually. Our speaker this year will be Latasha Brown. She is a co-founder of Black Voters Matter. It's going to be a great event. Latasha Brown brings a pretty interesting and unique perspective as her organization did quite a bit of work around voter education, voter mobilization, and doing the work to increase the voter rolls and to counter some of the impacts of those who perhaps feel marginalized relative to the political process in general and to the voting experience specifically. So that event is at 7 p.m. on Monday. There are e-flyers that have been circulated. I'll be sure, Spencer, to share one of those with you so that if any of your listeners perhaps wish to receive that, they can reach out to you or they can reach out to the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, either on our website or by email at odi@albany.edu. Again, that's odi@albany.edu.
That's great. Thank you for sharing the information on those two events. Is the exhibit open to the public, and how would somebody from the public get to Campus Center West?
So the event, the physical display, because it's on loan from the New York State Museum for a limited time, is not open to the public. We have that exhibit on loan for the enjoyment of the University at Albany community, students, faculty, and staff. And it will be returned to the State Museum. We plan to return that in March unless we receive an extension of the loan of those materials. So anyone in the general public would be able to take advantage of that at the New York State Museum at that time. And the event that's virtual is open to the greater community. So they can certainly feel free to log on to a computer or a smart device of their convenience and enjoy what is primed to be a great event, which again is at 7 p.m. on Monday, the 22nd.
Great. Thanks again.
You're more than welcome.
And so, Sam, as the interim chief diversity officer, what are you pushing for at UAlbany in terms of Black history education, and what already being done to educate students on Black history?
Yep, I appreciate the question. There are multiple activities that are actually being undertaken by the Student Association as well around Black identity. And I am happy to follow up with you, Spencer, to ensure that your audience has a sense of what those events are. One thing that I think is pretty interesting is that we're looking to engage students who have some sense of connectedness to the Black community by ensuring that they understand the diversity of the community. So you have students who identify as African American, you have students who may identify as Caribbean American, we have students from multiple racial influences, including being African heritage students. So I think really just outlining for the campus in general that virtually any community, the Black community, to use a term, certainly is not a monolith. There is a tremendous amount of diversity within the community and intersectionality within the community that I think this month provides a pretty good opportunity to perhaps slow the dialogue down a little bit so that people might be able to learn a bit more about what that looks like.
And is there anything else you wanted to share about diversity at the school or just Black History Month?
Sure. What I'd like to share is that there are no shortage of acknowledgments relative to different communities. So what I'd ask, particularly for students, is to take advantage of the resources that are offered by the Intercultural Student Engagement Team that would allow for students to really just kind of find their space without regard to how they identify. And that could be along racial lines, ethnic lines, gender expression, sexual orientation. There are so many communities within the larger UAlbany community that we want to ensure that anyone is able to just find a space that they're comfortable in. And because we have the pretty unique and interesting perspective of being a very diverse university in the Northeastern United States, I would not want anyone to take for granted that other institutions offer the level of diversity that the University at Albany does. So I appreciate, again, the opportunity to share, Spencer. We're focused here in this office on doing a couple of things. We want to foster a campus climate that's more inclusive. We want to cultivate a learning environment that's inclusive. And we're focused on recruitment and retention of faculty, staff, administrators, and graduate students who better reflect the multidimensional diversity of not only our undergraduate student population, but the community at large. So it's been great just to have an opportunity to share with you. And I look forward to having an opportunity to perhaps do so again in the future.
That's great, Sam. Thanks so much. And as a student at UAlbany, I just would also like to mention that I've been to two other local private universities and schools, and UAlbany definitely has the most coverage of Black History Month. And you mentioned diversity, definitely the most diverse and inclusive student body. And I think those are two things that are really valuable and have made me feel really comfortable at the University at Albany. So you can tell that your office's work has been working in the past decades and continues to do more. So I want to thank you, Sam, for your time, and hope to hear from you again soon.
That sounds real good, Spencer. Thanks again. Have a great weekend, and enjoy the balance of Black History Month. Take good care.
Take care.
On February 22nd at 7 p.m., UAlbany will host a virtual celebration honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The event will be hosted by LaTosha Brown, co-founder by Black Voters Matter.
Malcolm X was a prominent figure in the Black freedom struggles. WOOC roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry caught up with Brother X of the Capital Region in a five-part segment. Malcolm's views and thoughts and how they apply to today's freedom struggle. This is part two of a five-part series.
Yeah, Malcolm, he was very revolutionary. And like you said, there is not a major celebration of Malcolm, a quiet celebration, except for people who are active. They did something like that to Martin Luther King, too. Even though they celebrate him, they only celebrate, you know, mainly I Have a Dream part, rather than the end of his life, where he talked more radical things about this society and changing the society.
Absolutely, yes.
Right. So let me just get in some question about Malcolm X's views on Black history and hear what you have to say about this. One of Malcolm's famous saying about Black history that he stated in one of his speeches was the story of the difference between the field and the house Negro. So what are your thoughts on that statement in today's Black community?
Well, it still exists very much today, as it did when Malcolm spoke on it. And he talked about that from a book he had read, and then he had actually met the gentleman who had read who had written the book. And he talked about that. He made that known in all his speeches once he had come across the literature and read the literature thoroughly. And like you said, he's very analytical. And he's someone that would read something, a newspaper, before an interview and memorize all that he read and use that information for his argument during debates or what have you. And so when you have the house Negro, field Negro argument or description, you're talking about someone who is happy with society the way they are, with the way it is, does not mind that white Americans are in control globally or internationally, and is looking for a place within the proverbial house. Mm-hmm. The proverbial house is the American society, the American superstructure that it is, and that they have a place to take care of their family, to have a home, maybe have some land. They are entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. They maybe have a business. But to attack the political economic infrastructure that is America, the very exploitive entity that it is, and the way it murders Black. We're talking about murdering people without any problems at all. And they're not focused on acquiring justice. They believe that they're cutting fodder, that they're sacrifices for those elite Blacks and middle-class Blacks who live high on the horse. Mm-hmm. And so as long as they don't deal with the real political issues that our people have, that they play a role in getting the vote, but Blacks don't get anything for their vote, and that anybody who is more militant or angry or more aggressive, that they speak openly and hostilely against them, that would be the field Negro. The field Negro wanted to leave the plantation, wanted to see it burned down, wanted to see the plantation owner harmed because he remembered the babies being stomped on. He remembered his uncles and brothers being sold away or his baby being hung. He remembers the rapings of his wife that he had to have in secrecy. He remembers being taken from the ships from his homeland. So he remembers these things. And whenever he gets a chance, he's looking for some people who is ready to leave this decadent place and build something for their own. People don't realize that hundreds of slave rebellions happened during the time of antebellum slavery, that our people were rebelling from the time they got here into the time we were able to free ourselves. We freed ourselves. No Lincoln freed us. We freed ourselves. You had no point when you have aggressive Blacks who get hands on guns and help you win war, but knowing you cannot put them back on plantations because they've had a taste of freedom, they have a taste of aggression, that they have killed not only their own brothers, but whites as well. And so that's the spirit Malcolm inculcated. And so Black History Month, you can argue, is the House Negroes History Month, because what we deal with is that Negroes who made contributions to American society were never compensated. You're talking about every African in the diaspora probably are owed $1 trillion if you want to make it a monetary thing, because all the creations that we made that we get not compensated for. You know, you can deal with George Washington Carver and all his creations, and you may be up to $1 billion just with him by himself. So when Malcolm talked about the history, and then he would go into, you know, the history of Africa, he wanted his people to get away from what the white man says is our history and create a history of your own, or search or history of your own, because it's there if you look hard enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of lead me into this another question that I want to ask you too, about Malcolm X said during Black History, once during Black History Week, it was called a week way back, not a month. He said, we never talk about what's going on before we ended up in America. And just want to ask you, how important do you think talking about what happened to us before we were brought to America in this Black History Month?
Very important. Very important. I think that's where where it should start. That, especially towards our youth, some of our adults are pretty much gone because they've been Christianized completely. And if it's not in the Bible, they don't want to know anything about it. So you redirect your energies to youth who are hungry and want to learn about their past and what they've created. You deal with the pyramids. You deal with the creation of the pyramids and the science they can't duplicate now. You deal with the Metanature and the brain surgeries and the Hemotep, who was the world's first genius who could do any and all things. And you connect their bloodline to that great bloodline. And now you go from a slave behavior to a creation behavior, a nation creation behavior, a owner, you know, a controller, a governor. You say, well, where did the Bible come from? Where did the Constitution come from? Black people created the language that was in these legal documents that no longer are used to empower us, but used to subjugate us. But we created literature that these people that are in control couldn't speak and couldn't walk right until they came in contact with us. You know, you're the civilizers of the world. Mm-hmm. When the European death of the Black Death was controlling and going through Europe, it was our Moorish brothers and sisters who went to Spain and Europe and cleaned up that place when 85% of the population was dying. That shows you the love that you have of humanity, that you will go into literally a death continent, risk your own life, but to clean it up and save those people. And so these stories aren't told. And because they like for our youth to think that they're the criminal deviants that is shown on nightly news day in and day out. I said, no, you come from a bloodline of great people who believed in life. They studied life and they tried to create a society where everybody could live comfortably and like humans. Everybody created was part of the nation. No one person was bigger than anybody else. And that's including the king. Mm-hmm. This is African constitution that legitimately, literally existed, that the king was no bigger than anyone else. We live in a society now where the president can do whatever he wants and he knows he's not going to jail. And everybody who's watching him knows he's not going to jail. We have several murderous presidents. Matter of fact, all of them are murderous presidents, but it's just mainstream. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the Bushes, both Bushes. You're talking about a Trump. You're talking about a Biden and his vice president. But you're talking about Obama. Mm-hmm. With all the African lives that were killed or are taken. And so, you know, when we show them what we were and you compare it to society now, and, you know, what's the common denominator? Or why aren't we what we were before? Well, look at the people in power. You have to ask them. You know, we can give you the history on that, certainly, but we need you to ask some questions. Ask them what happened to our greatness and why we're no longer that great. So it's important for us to know that King Mansa Musa, the richest man in the world, $400 billion, went around the globe giving money away.
Right.
Again, shows to our greatness to our people, and it's important that we learn that.
And they go further to say that they tried to do this during Black History Month to say that Black people history started when we came to America, but we know that wasn't true, and that's why it's important that our kids know that we have a long history.
That was correspondent Willie Terry, talking with Brother X of the Capital Region in that 5-part segment about Malcolm's views and thoughts about how they apply to today's freedom struggles. You can listen to the rest of this interview by visiting our website at mediasanctuary.org.
For those just tuning in, I'm Kalen.
And I'm Justin. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOA 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA 107.3 FM Albany.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Pamela Kapalit is the founder and lead financial advisor at Brush and Budget, whose core focus is to be a catalyst for a power shift and believes that personal finance is a revolutionary act. Sina Basila Hickey talked with Pamela about the concept behind her business, our relationships with our finances, and the racial wealth divide, and the Brunch and Budget podcast.
Thank you, Pamela Kapalin, for speaking with me. I first heard about your work after my sister invited you over to her apartment for brunch to talk about her finances. So what is the concept behind Brunch and Budget?
I love that. That's so awesome. So thank you for having me, first of all. I'm so excited to be on. The concept for Brunch and Budget is kind of exactly what it sounds like. We literally, pre-pandemic, of course, we had a meal and would talk about your finances. And I would meet people for brunch at restaurants or just like what your sister did. I definitely had people invite me over to their homes and make a meal. And, you know, the reason behind the brunch aspect of it really came from people being really nervous and scared to talk about their finances. And for some reason, food just makes everything easier. That's really where it came from. It came from a lot of my friends asking me questions and really not knowing where to start. And what I found was that, you know, breaking bread with someone, having a meal with them, sharing food just really changed the dynamic. And it really allowed people to feel more comfortable to have this conversation. We just have so much shame and embarrassment around money. You know, we're told that we made all these mistakes. We feel very alone in it. That's what I've learned, you know, working with people through Brunch and Budget. And the brunch part of it, the food part of it, really, I don't know, it really just, it really allowed us to find some common ground and really, and have some real conversations around it.
To repeat what you said, for people, they're overwhelmed and embarrassed about their finances. So how does trauma factor into people's money habits?
Oh, it's such a huge factor. Our relationship with money is something that starts really, really young, younger than you think. I co-founded a financial literacy program for youth called Pockets Change. And we were doing a workshop with 5 and 6 year olds. And a 6 year old came up to us and said, "Hey, are we talking about money today? I hope not, because I'm bad at money." You know, and she was six. Right?
Right.
And so these ideas about money and this relationship with money that we have as adults actually started really young. And it started with how our parents talked to or didn't talk to us about money, the stress that was at home, and also really just like the bombardment of people telling you what you should be doing, where you should be, how much money you should have, yes, what you should and shouldn't buy, how much you should or shouldn't have saved. And I think we start getting those signals early, like 5 and 6 year olds know whether they're savers or spenders, right? What does that even mean? Do they have money? Do they have income? Do they have jobs? No, but their parents tell them like, "Wow, you spend a lot of money," or "Wow, you're really good at saving." And I think those kinds of even like seemingly innocent things carry with us through adulthood. I think the other thing about trauma and money that is really unaddressed is, you know, we do a lot of work around the racial wealth divide. And the reason why that's so important is because we have a lot of clients of color who are now currently like the, you know, financial breadwinner for multiple generations of family, right? They're making more money than their families did. They were the first in their family to go to college. They don't have a history of home ownership. And what we've seen too with a lot of our clients of color is if they grew up in poverty, then even no matter how much income you make, if you don't really figure out what your money habits are that came from poverty, then it's really hard to move forward, right? Because there's so many habits that are not only generational, but they're habits that were designed to help your family survive, but not necessarily thrive.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned kids and the environment that we all grow up in. Is there some advice that you would give to a parent who wants to create a healthy environment for their kids in relationship to finances?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's going to be different at every age, but it's going to be important to start talking to your kids about money and start talking to them about what it means if you say we can't afford this or we can't afford that. I'll tell you personally, for me, I have kind of been exploring my own childhood and around money recently. And one of the things that I realized was, so my mom lost her job when I was young. I didn't know that had happened but I did know that there was a lot of tension and stress in the house, and it seemed like it was about money, and I didn't know why. And I think that if my mom had sat me down and found a way to tell me that she lost her job, even at that age, I thought it was me. I thought, because kids always think it's them, right? You always think that you're the reason why your parents are stressed or mad or angry. And I associated that with money too. And so I think that as a parent, we want to shield our kids from these things, but they already pick up on that stuff. They can already sense it. And I just want to encourage parents, because kids make up these stories in their heads already, to reveal some of the reality of what's actually going on when it comes to money.
Brunch and Budget is much more than just a financial advising service, but a lot of what you do is educate people on the ties between finances and injustice. How important is it to understand the history of financial injustice, to understand your current financial hardships and also the community around you?
Oh my gosh, it is. I always say you can't talk about money without talking about race. The racial wealth divide exists because not only were there policies and programs in this country that were enacted by the federal government to perpetuate a racial wealth divide and to perpetuate specifically Black Americans not being able to build wealth for generations and generations and generations, right? Starting with chattel slavery and then along the way denying Black Americans homeownership, the ability to own homes, you know, denying Black Americans the ability to have higher paying jobs, all of those kinds of things. This kind of stuff still shows up currently today. And I think that if we don't examine that, one, there's two sides of it. I think that understanding, one, that it's not your fault necessarily that you didn't get a higher paying job, that you have student loan debt, that you don't own a home right now, right? I think the other side of it is recognizing what privileges you do have. I think that one thing that I always think being the exact same income, right? They're each making $100,000 and one client is able to save and they're on their way to buying a house and, you know, they don't have any student loan debt. And then we have another client who has trouble saving, has credit card debt, has student loan debt, is sending money back home to their parents. They're the ones paying for their family's cell phone plan. And so even though they're making the same amount of income, the financial obligations often of our clients of color are just tenfold that of our white clients. And so I think examining money and injustice together is one of the critical parts to not only establishing your own like personal financial success and what that means for you, but to also think of your personal finances as an act of revolution. I think that when we understand the history of it and how these systems work, we're able to empower not only ourselves, but also our communities to actually pass policies that move all of us forward.
What are some actions that our listeners can take against the racial divide?
The thing that I always think about is how much being afraid of your money stops you from doing things that would actually help your money. And what I mean by that is I have, just to give you an example, I have a lot of clients who are freelancers and they've been freelancers for a while, right? Like before the gig economy was a thing, you know, especially a lot of creative people were making 1099 income. And a lot of them come to me and they're like, Pam, I haven't filed my taxes in 4 years.
Wow.
Right? I was told to get paid under the table. I was told to hide my money from the IRS. You know, I filed my taxes 1 year and I got a big tax bill. So I was just too afraid to file them again. What ends up happening is that you end up not being able to buy a home. You end up not being able to increase your income. You end up always wanting to just tread right above water because you're afraid that if you make more money that the tax people will come and arrest you. Like I've literally had people say, I don't want to go to jail. So I've just been hiding for 4 years, right? And when you're in that position, it feels like that you can't do anything except for survive. And I mentioned earlier, you know, the difference between surviving and thriving and the habits that we have that either help us survive or help us thrive. And I think one of the things when it comes to personal finance is what are the things that you're doing that someone told you to do that are actually you feel like that you're going to get in big trouble? Because what I will tell you right now is everything is fixable. Everything is fixable. There's things that we can get figured out. And from what I've seen in all of the clients that we've worked with, sometimes it really is just a matter of taking your hands away from in front of your eyes and saying like, let me just look at where I am today, because then I can figure out like what needs to happen next. We're really against the idea of personal responsibility and the idea of personal responsibility rhetoric. And just to really explain what that means, a lot of personal finance is around, well, it's your fault. You just didn't do it right. You got into credit card debt because you were irresponsible. You spent money frivolously. You didn't save enough. All of these things are placed on the individual without taking into account what the context of your situation is. And I think that when you start to understand the actual context of your situation and you can see how your personal finances really play into that, that's really when you can really start to like advocate for yourself too.
So one of the stressful situations for myself with money is understanding that there's the things that you invest in. There's, you know, if I invest in a bank, the banks are pretty much always involved in really terrible things. The food that you mm-hmm. are buying is maybe being picked by underwage laborers who are not in good conditions. It's all packed in plastic. So how can people balance investing in yourself and also spending in alignment with your values?
Ooh, yes, that is always a difficult question. And one of the things that we like to say, because one, everything you just said was like, holy shit, why should I even try? It's so overwhelming, right?
Right.
Why should I even try? And I think that's kind of the spiral that a lot of us go down is, well, if I do this one thing, but I don't do this other thing, then I'm not perfect at it and I should just give it all up. The reality is we live in a capitalist system. So no individual action that you take is going to be perfect. That's just impossible, right? Until we start to see our systems change, then I think on an individual level, one of the things that we like to say is instead of trying to boycott something, we encourage you to boycott things. And as you're able to say yes to more and more of those purchases that are in line with your values, then you'll look back and you'll see like, oh my gosh, most of my money is going towards places that I value. Most of my money is intentionally getting spent in alignment with my values. And I think that's really the best place to start is saying yes to things that you really believe in first.
What are some of the topics that you address in Brunch and Budget Podcast?
Yeah, we like to say that our podcast is about personal finance and racial economic inclusion. I think that, again, when it comes to understanding the systemic stuff in the context of your personal finances, we have to address all of it, right? And it's really complex. And so just to give you an idea, one of the most recent episodes we had is the racist history of insurance and why you need it anyway, right? The insurance company you go with is going to be far from perfect. They're going to have done terrible things in the past. They're currently doing terrible things now. And you still need insurance to protect your wealth. So how do we understand how that works and still be able to protect our personal finances at the same time? And I think that's really like an encapsulation of what we talk about on the podcast. It's not, again, like you said, it's not just about personal finance. It's not just about the racial wealth divide. I think that the intersection of those things and the way that we try and address those topics is one of the main missions of the podcast, because we're also big believers that a lot of the personal finance rhetoric was created because of culture and art and media. And I think that when we start to shift our mindset and our culture and our media more in the direction of understanding these things and not have it be about like, oh, it's all your fault. If you just do all the right things, you'll be all right. Because that's not what happens, right? But if we start to shift the culture and start to make it something where people are not only informed about their finances, but they're informed about the financial system and the system that got us to where we are today and the system that created the racial wealth divide, then collectively, we're all able to make that cultural shift. And that's, I think, where the overwhelm starts to dissipate a little bit, right? Because you let go of your need as an individual to do everything perfectly. Because at the end of the day, capitalism is about the individual, and we need to shift towards a more collective voice and a more collective culture around taking care of everybody.
So how can our listeners find more about Brunch and Budget? How can we find you?
If you go to brunchandbudget.com, that's all the info for our services, for our podcast, brunchandbudget.com/podcast. We're also on every podcast platform, so you can just search for Brunch and Budget. And we are also on Twitter and Instagram at Brunch and Budget.
Thank you so much for speaking with me. I think our listeners are going to get a lot out of this.
Thank you so much.
That was our own Sina Basila Hickey speaking with Pamela Kapaled about her brunch and budget podcast. Ruth Ann Smalley is a children's book author and healer. She wrote the book Defender of Dirt to inform young children about climate change and how they can play their role. This is part one of two segments with HMM correspondent Erica Diggs.
This is HMM correspondent Erica Dulcinea Diggs from the Media Sanctuary. And today I'm speaking with Ruth Smalley. She is the author of The Defender in Dirt. She wrote this book in 2012. This book is discussing an issue that is overlooked by many Americans. Please welcome Ruth Smalley. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for coming on the show. So tell us, what is your background?
Well, my training is as an English professor. And I taught college level for many years. And then I stepped out to raise my children. And during that time, I got very interested in the climate issues and began wanting to write books for children that conveyed positive messages about how, you know, children could take a role in caring for the earth.
And what made you so interested in the climate change that we're currently going through?
Well, at the time that I started reading about it, it really wasn't a huge subject in the media. And I had thought I was up on, you know, current issues. As a college professor, I wanted to, you know, make sure my antenna were up and that I knew what was going on, but I really, you know, found out otherwise. And it was a bit of a shock to realize that I had been that out of touch. And because I had young children at the time, it sort of loomed larger as, you know, oh no, we're not really coping with this. This is going to be something that our kids have to deal with. And not only are we not talking about it as adults, we're not adjusting the way that we are raising our children and the way that we're educating them to prepare them for the role that they're going to have in, you know, facing this really, really huge difference in the way humans are going to be living on the earth.
So you're trying to tell me in 2012, you were thinking 20 years ahead of time, pretty much, and what your kids were going to go through with the climate.
Exactly. And I thought, you know, I don't think what they're learning in school, and that's why I was also homeschooling at the time, but even in my homeschooling group, I didn't find people really thinking in these terms about, you know, how do we raise children who are resilient, who have tools, who know how to problem solve, because they're going to have really new and different problems than we faced.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, so where and when did you find your love of writing, your love for writing?
Well, I've always been an avid journal keeper. And I mean, I've pretty much, since I was probably in middle school, been someone who writes to process my thoughts and ideas. And as a college professor, I taught writing courses. And once I stepped out to raise my kids, I taught fun creative writing courses in my homeschool group. And it's just always been a way for me to problem solve, I guess, to go back to my earlier point that, you know, getting things into words and identifying them and getting into the details about what you're thinking are just huge steps toward taking an action. So a lot of people have this idea that, you know, someone's writing off in their little ivory tower and it's all, you know, navel gazing or whatever. But in fact, I want people to be able to use writing as a stepping stone to, you know, manifesting change in the world, taking an action.
Yes, definitely. I'm a firm believer in manifestation. You know, I tell people about that all the time. They'll look at me like, what are you talking? I'm like, anything I do currently is spoken into existence. And any other person I've met who is at a certain level in their life,
it's, you know, it's the word. The word is powerful. Yeah.
Okay. So what are some techniques you could give to new writers?
Well, I'm a big advocate of spilling, you know, that give yourself a chance to write whatever is in your mind at the time, because there's a lot of unprocessed material that we're all going around with in our minds. And within that, there will be nuggets. So you got to work through the, you know, the fluff, the chaff to get to the nuggets. And you need to kind of offload a certain amount of just junk that's in your head at any given time before you get to the nuggets. So I really suggest that people find out about a writing method called proprioceptive writing, which it's set up around the notion that you give yourself 25 minutes to just listen to your brain and write down what you hear and don't censor anything. And what I find with that process is that I come out at the end with every time at least one, if not more, realizations where I've connected the dots on something. It's maybe not something I've never thought before, but I have a new sense of the importance of it, or I put it together in a new way. And so that's really valuable, just letting yourself have that time to find out what's in there.
Sort of letting go and freestyling anything that's in your mind.
Yeah. We call it free writing in, you know, composition classrooms.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So what does your book mean to you? And is that the first book you've ever published?
No. I'll answer your second question first. The first book that was published was my book, Sheila Says We're Weird. And it's a picture book, but is really like a condensed version of Defender of Dirt, put in a form that younger children can enjoy more. And so I did write Defender of Dirt first, but Sheila Says We're Weird is the one that got published first. What does it mean to me? I was really looking for books to share with my children that would have a positive take on what I call Earth stewardship. So how does a person take care of their own environment? And I really wasn't seeing a lot that I thought was pertinent or fun or had a certain aesthetic quality to it as well. It would, you know, some of the environmentally oriented books for children tend to be very factual. And then there's sort of the other extreme where it's kind of like a fantasy world that's, you know, trying to make the message. And I wanted something realistic, but something that would be fun and funny and delightful and have a narrative quality to it. So there's a story there, not just a pile of facts. So that's what I set out to write. And I've got a lot of other manuscripts sort of in the making that are similar in that way, that, you know, want to take a lighthearted approach to something that's actually quite serious and important, but is, you know, on the level that a kid can really relate to.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You know, folks, I read the book myself, and as an adult, I enjoyed it. And I was very shocked because, like, you know, I really assumed it was for children. But, you know, getting in tune with the issue that I wasn't so familiar on was definitely something I enjoyed. And I recommend you guys get this book for your children.
Yeah, I like to talk about it as a family book. I mean, Defender of Dirt was really written to start conversations between adults and kids. And so there's a lot of things in the book and in the sequel that I've just finished that are definitely conversation starters. They're not going to be totally explained within the book itself. So the family is going to need to talk about it and have a discussion and maybe even go, you know, online and look up some things about it, because I want it to sort of spark interest and make people curious. And what you said about adults enjoying it, one of the places that I was selling it was this herbalist called Jean's Greens. And I noticed that she put it in her catalog, her mail order catalog, under the adult section. And I was like, hey, you know, why didn't you list this with your children's books? And she said, I have adults come in all the time who buy this and they like to read it. And I was like, oh, well, that's nice to know, because, you know, I didn't dumb anything down. You know, it's really information there that we all need.
Absolutely. And I completely agree with what you say. When some people write children's books, they completely just provide factual information and make it so, you know, not as enjoyable, as you said, to a child. And you thought like a child for a second and put yourself in the child's shoe and was like, what would a kid, if I was a kid right now in 2020 or 2012, what would I want to read?
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad it comes across that way.
Definitely, definitely. It seems like your message got across the way you wanted it to. Okay, so what are some workshops you offer?
I have currently been offering a workshop called Introduction to Bullet Journaling. And this is a method for helping you organize your life, but it's also a mindfulness method. So it combines a kind of conventional planner, you know, bulleted lists and calendars with a personal journal And so there's a pretty clear and simple template to use for it. And it gives people a starting point. But the beauty of the bullet journal is that you can infinitely customize it and personalize it. So I've been having a really good time teaching people how to start their own bullet journal and trying to counteract people's fears that, oh, I can't do this because they've gone online and looked at, you know, YouTubers doing bullet journals who are like graphic designers and, you know, can't, most of us can't do that. So bullet journal workshops, that method I mentioned earlier about the proprioceptive writing, I love teaching workshops on that because it's, again, it's so much about the person sitting there on the other end of, you know, my talk. It's, they're going to use it for themselves in ways that I will never even imagine. So those are the two that are kind of the main ones right now for me, but I'm always open also to other suggestions or requests. And on a side note, I'm also trained in energy medicine methodologies, which is based on a kind of electromagnetic model of the body that's related to the Chinese system of the acupuncture meridians. So I combine teaching workshops about writing and self-development with tools for exploring yourself as an energy body, because it really connects in people's words, their ability to speak and use their voice are often really, really related to what's going on energetically for them. If they've been sort of shut down in the past for speaking out, or they have self-image issues, or they're just nervous. Nervousness does not lead to good writing. So I also have workshops where I combine more sort of conventional journal writing methods with an interest in the mind-body system.
Okay, folks, you just heard from Miss Ruth Smalley. She wrote the book Defender in the Dirt, and Sheila says we're weird.
An interesting and intriguing piece from Erica Diggs and Ruth Smalley. This is a part one of a part two segment. Next, we have a segment from the ACT series, which was created by the students of the Spring 21 Art Community Technology class at RPI. In this segment, student Anika Strelo interviews Strays Jess Bennett of Friends of the Mohican Tuck, which is an organization aimed at preserving indigenous land and educating our community.
Hello, everyone. My name is Anika Strelo. I'm from Art Community in Technology. And with me today, I have Jess from Friends of the Mohican Tuck. And so, Jess, what would you say your organization's main message is, and how have you been able to impact the community with it?
Thanks for asking, Anika. Our organization, Friends of the Mohican Tuck, we're a broad coalition of concerned community members, Indigenous people, and just anybody can really kind of get involved with us who is interested in preserving 101 Second Avenue. Our kind of broad ultimate goal is to preserve the land, keep it from any development whatsoever, and put it in preservation for generations of Trojans to come to enjoy the land and also learn from its history as we are right now.
Yeah, for sure. So I know you touched on it a little bit. What are some of the current specific goals and initiatives you're working on?
So right now, the legal battle has kind of been making its way through the Troy Planning Commission and City Council. But ultimately, we would like to work with the current owner of the land to put it into preservation. And so this is kind of a many kind of pronged maneuver here, where we're both raising awareness within the community, as well as creating partners on the local, regional, and even state level that have a lot of experience doing this with other pieces of land. You know, this is not a straightforward path of we have the option to purchase it and then we purchase it and everything's done. So we're kind of moving forward in a lot of different fronts, and it's been a really interesting process so far.
Awesome. And then, you know, obviously with the COVID-19 pandemic right now, everything's kind of unconventional. Have you had any big challenges since the start of the pandemic?
I think in a way, since all of this has happened during the pandemic, It's lent itself in an odd way to being more conducive to people organizing. You don't need to leave your house to go to the city council meeting on a 6 o'clock on a Thursday night. You can sit in your living room and do it in the same way that people aren't leaving their houses quite so much. They're spending a lot more time online. And so social media has become an even bigger tool for getting the word out. And certainly I think it could be said that COVID has led to kind of the summer of BLM and this kind of raising and amplifying of indigenous voices. Again, that ties into this land so well, and people are waking up in some ways for the first time and really kind of taking a look at what's in their backyard. And in this case, here we are needing their help. So in a way, I think the pandemic has actually worked to our benefit in this strange way.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. You've kind of grabbed it by the reins. Besides, you know, you talked about the town hall meetings and stuff. Have you had any other unique opportunities recently, either due to the pandemic or just in general?
Opportunities. We've had, certainly the pandemic, we can't all get together and do a land walk, but what it's afforded a lot of us is a more kind of intimate look through the eyes of people who we're walking around the land with. We've been able to work with geologists and ecologists, former city and county historians who have a great, you know, back knowledge of this, the history of this land, have all walked with us. And in a normal year, we might be like, oh, here's the address, you know, let us know what you think. But here it's kind of this like very much more intimate experience. And I think what it does is once you come and you look at the land and you have this connection, you become so much more dedicated. And I'm just overwhelmed with gratitude at the energy that people are giving this project. But I really do think it has something to do with the kind of odd set of circumstances we're in now. So it's pretty amazing all around.
So yeah, with that being said, how could listeners reach out to you to either connect, donate, start volunteering with you?
We would love it if people would connect with us. Check out our website. That's always the first place to find out more information, which is save1011.org. You can sign up for our mailing list there. We've also got a petition online with, at the moment, I believe it's over 2,500 signatures. And we also have a legal fund because we are anticipating, a future legal fight that we want to be kind of on top of and able to move at the moment. But it takes a village and many hands make light work. So if you're at all interested in getting involved, please jump on our website, get on the mailing list, and we'd love to have your help.
Awesome. Thank you. And, finally, is there anything else you wanted to tell our listeners or anything they should know?
What I'd love for people to take from this, and I'm certainly taking from this, is that this is something that we all can do in our community. You don't have to have gone to Harvard Law to make a difference on your local city government level. You don't have to have a PhD in ecology to have a real appreciation for the forest in your backyard and want to save it. So everybody can make a difference. And we're seeing that every day in this fight.
Awesome. So, well, thank you so much, Jess. I appreciate the time you took out of your day to interview with us.
Thank you, Annika.
That was Annika Strelo interviewing Jess Bennett of the Friends of the Mahicantuck as part of the ACT series. Well, that concludes another show of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Kalen.
And I'm Justin. Our engineer is Sina Basila Hickey. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get this dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or join our weekly Zoom meeting right after this call on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending us an email request, requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in and stay safe out there.